A warning, this podcast uses the sound of gunshots, live reports, firsthand accounts, and other sounds related to active shootings. If you need crisis counseling related to shootings, the National Disaster Distress Hotline is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call 1-800-985-5990 or text 66746. If you know someone who may be a danger to the community or may be considering an act of violence yourself, please seek help. You can call your local authorities immediately. Many times you can be anonymous. Sandy Hook Promise also has a tip system called Say Something Tips. Just go to sandyhookpromise.org. When Robert Crimo III entered the courtroom for jury selection on February 24th, I was sitting in the media row, elbow to elbow with colleagues from various Chicago media outlets. Some had been following the case closely, others were just there for the day to do their morning hits and then hand things off to the afternoon crew. I cleared off this week from my work schedule. I wanted to be here. I wanted to see who was chosen for the jury and how they were picked. Judge Victoria Rossetti expected a month-long trial to follow. But as the lawyer settled in, I overheard the Lake County State's attorney say my name. I couldn't make it out completely, but he sounded like he was asking someone in his office if I was in the courtroom. Then I saw the state's attorney, Eric Reinhart, huddle with some of his people to the left of me. Then they walked over to the defense team to the right of me. And after a brief conversation, he turned his attention to Media Row and asked if Ryan Burrow was here. I raised my hand. He asked if he could have a word with me outside of the courtroom. So I stood up and started heading out. One of the reporters from NBC, who I actually went to college with, asked me, "What's this all about?" I told him, "Probably not good." I followed the state's attorney into the vestibule between the courtroom and the lobby. And there he told me I could potentially be called as a witness at the trial due to the letters I had received from Bobby Crimo, including the one where he said he wanted to kill Jews and offered to be swapped for Hamas prisoners. He then told me that Judge Victoria Rossetti had already ruled that any non-victim witnesses could not be in the courtroom during the trial outside of their own testimony, which was, of course, true. It was one of Judge Rossetti's rulings just prior to jury selection. He told me he'd asked the judge to clarify in court, but he did not think I would be allowed in the courtroom during the trial. Of course, I was stunned. I didn't say anything. I just went back to my seat. To more question from my friend, what was that all about? And I told him, I think we're about to see. So the Lake County State's attorney asked the judge in front of everyone whether a non-victim witness could remain in the courtroom if they were a member of the media. Judge Rossetti said no. So he turned and looked at me. "Well, looks like I'm out," I said to my friend. I grabbed my bags and shuffled through the congested row. I felt like every eye in the courtroom was on me. As I stepped out of the courtroom toward the lobby, one of the state's attorney's assistants chased me down and asked for my contact information. So I went out to my car. Now what? A million thoughts raced through my head. Everything from who will cover the trial to can I report this to when will I have to testify? Do I need to get a lawyer? My first email was to my boss in HR to tell them what had happened. I was off the trial and could be called to testify. Then I texted my friend, still up in the courtroom, obviously still confused about what had just happened. He texted me that all the media was asking the state's attorney's media contact what had happened. And he later texted me that the state's attorney was asking potential jurors if they knew anyone on the witness list, and that did include my name. Covering this trial was going to be a gamble for me. It wasn't high priority with all of my other responsibilities, but I thought I could make it work. So knowing my march was now back to normal was a little bit of a relief. We had TV partners in the courtroom. We'd still be able to get the day-to-day stuff from court. But this was frustrating. I wanted to be there. I felt like I had dedicated a lot of time and mental energy to being there, only to have it ripped away. So I started driving back to the radio station, my mind swimming with thoughts and ideas. I thought, I might as well get this onto the air. So I pulled over to McDonald's and called WGN's John Williams.
Ryan Burrow joins us on WGN. Where are you, Ryan? I was in Waukegan to start the day, but it turns out I was told that I will not be allowed to be at the courtroom anymore. Just to kind of summarize everything that's been going on today, jury selection is underway, as you mentioned. The jurors, when I had left, were doing questionnaires. The judge admitted that those were taking a little bit longer than expected. At that point, they'll start asking questions to people in person. This process could take several days. We were not anticipating opening statements to begin until Monday. So this could take, you know, a couple days, a couple hours, could take, you know, the full week to finally settle a jury. I was talking with Judy Wang from WGN-TV downstairs. I mean, it's going to be hard to find people who don't know about the shooting. But on the other hand, too, you don't necessarily need to find people who don't know about the shooting. You need to find people who can be fair and are open-minded to the evidence that's presented before them.
Why were you not allowed in the courtroom?
Well, John, as we discussed on Friday, I've been communicating with the suspected shooter, Robert Cremo III. We've exchanged a few letters, and in them he basically indicted himself. So those letters, which the state's attorney does have, may be used in court, and I may be called to testify. On Thursday, Judge Rossetti ruled that while victim witnesses may be allowed in the courtroom, during the trial, that doesn't mean all witnesses. In fact, no witnesses who are not victim witnesses, and technically I could be called. So they said, sorry, you cannot participate in this trial at all. So they took down my information, and I don't know, maybe I get called. We'll see.
Did they subpoena your email exchanges with Cremo?
When I received the letters, I had an exchange with the state attorney's office to alert them to the letter. At that point, they hadn't said anything, but today, they had asked to see the letters. There was no subpoena at that time. I was actually just kind of sharing the information to see if I can get an interview, which did not turn out because there was a gag order. I guess that wasn't smartly played on my part, but...
Well, you did get an interview in a way. You did exchange correspondence with him, correct?
Yes, I meant to interview with the state's attorney about the trial itself and how he was prosecuting the case, because, one of the things that we talked about on Friday was this potentially being a hate crime. At least that's kind of what Robert Cremo III alluded to me, that this was a hate crime, which would obviously indict him as the gunman here. But he has not been charged with a hate crime in this case. He's only been charged with the murder charges. So
wait a minute, he hasn't been charged.
I didn't necessarily know that the letters would be used.
I think that's really interesting, Ryan, because has he stated why? He said that he did do it, and then he said he didn't do it. The circumstantial evidence has him on the roof with the gun. Let's just leave it at that. But has he said why he would have done it had he been the shooter? Did he give a motive?
Yeah, he
no, I don't mean to you. I don't mean to you, though. Yeah. I mean publicly.
Remember, he had a plea deal all scheduled this summer and then backed out of it. But to this point, he has still pleaded not guilty to the charges.
And yet, to you, he not only incriminated himself, but he gave an explanation for why he did it.
Correct. Yeah.
I don't know,
to be honest with you, John, if I'm going to be called. This is kind of fresh. This just happened, and it was kind of embarrassing because, I mean, it was the judge, it was Cremo, it was the defense, it was the prosecution, it was all the media. Cremo's parents were in there. There were a couple other people, and they literally said, Mr. Burrow, you have to leave. And I was texting with one of my media friends outside, and he's like, everyone wants to know why you were kicked out. So that's the reason why. We will be fine, by the way, for the listeners. We've got plenty of resources there. WGN-TV is there. We will have plenty of resources to cover this case, but I will not physically be allowed to be there in the courtroom.
I'm not sure why you shouldn't be allowed in the courtroom, but I can see why they would want access to your communication with him, because as I understand it, the penalty for a hate crime is different than the penalty for any other crime. Not that found guilty, this guy would ever see light of day anyway, but I could see where his communication to you, however contradictory it might be, would be compelling. I can see why that would be valuable to the prosecution.
And keep in mind, too, the prosecution has the interrogation tapes where he allegedly, and they have not I have FOIA'd it and asked for this video, but he allegedly confesses to the shooting. Now, that was permitted in court. That was something the defense fought against, but it is going to be permitted, so we know that that is going to be one of the things that's used. I don't know if my letters will have any contribution, and to be honest with you, I don't know how far this is going to go, because, you know, if he almost reached a plea deal this summer, and if all the cards are lining against him with the video, with my letters, with other things that they have, I mean, outside of just drawing this thing out as long as it can possibly go, I don't know what the defense's play is here, but we'll see. I mean, 4 to 6 weeks was what we were told that this trial could go.
Well, I suppose the families, the victims, the community, all of Chicagoland wants closure on this case. I think at times where a plea is copped, not that this guy's ever going to be free, that's blah, 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 alleged, whatever. But I mean, I do understand why they do want a conviction. They want the justice system. They want justice for the victims, and justice would be a conviction. They want him convicted for the crimes. So I can see why the prosecution would not offer much anyway, because it's important that people get that kind of closure. They want a pronouncement that somebody pulled the trigger for whatever reason. These people were injured, paralyzed, a child was, others were killed, and we want to stamp that as a conviction on the individual that did it. I think that's why you still go through this exercise, even though it just seems ludicrous that it's taken this long and that we have to go this charade of a trial when it is so apparent what happened here.
Yeah, I really don't have anything else to add. We're going to figure out kind of stuff on our end about, you know, being called as a witness, as, you know, WGN reporter, you know, to see how that all plays out. Admittedly, I've never been called as a witness before in a trial. It's all new for me. We'll see how it all plays out.
Immediately after I hung up with John, our HR rep got back to me with some options on fighting to get back into the courtroom and recommendations from Nexstar Legal on preparing to testify. Petitioning the judge to get back into the courtroom didn't really interest me. I also received an email from Nexstar's senior VP of local content development telling me because I could be a witness in this case, I should no longer report on it. That was a dagger right there. Not only did I have to get secondhand news, but even at the station, I couldn't do reports or updates on this trial. As I drove back, I pulled off two or three more times to make calls, respond to texts, and answer emails. I decided to file some stories for radio. I couldn't report on the trial, but nobody ever said I couldn't report on the letters or what had just happened in the courtroom. By 1 o'clock, I texted my boss that I was just going to head home. There was nothing left for me to do at the office but answer emails. I'd be back in tomorrow. The jury selection continued without me for several days. There was reference to my dismissal in court from the Sun-Times, maybe the Daily Herald, saying a member of the media was dismissed from being a witness. Made it sound like I was actually a witness to the shooting, which I was not, but technically it was correct. After the opening of jury selection, Cremo did not come back in the afternoon. And in fact, he decided to remain in his jail cell through the rest of jury selection, all the way until March 3rd, when a jury was finally picked. The trial would begin Monday. That's when Cremo made his move.
Cremo pleading guilty to all counts 1 through 21 for first-degree murder, 3 charges for each 7 people killed. The murder counts carry 7 natural life sentences. He would not be eligible for parole or early release. He also pled guilty to 48 counts of attempted first-degree murder, 1 count for every gunshot victim. Possible sentence on each count is 26 to 50 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections.
Though not surprising, the timing was. Cremo had said back in the summer that he would plead guilty, but then pulled that back, much to the frustration of the judge, attorneys, and the dozens of victims who wanted him to just go away.
We're all just sort of surprised and relieved that they don't have to experience the unbelievable pain of reliving this experience.
There would be no trial. I would not have to testify. My letters would never be shown in court. I wouldn't have to look Cremo in the eyes, or worse yet, have him look at me in the eyes. Sentencing would come in April. Later in March, I reached out to the state's attorney's office and asked if I could still cover the sentencing since I was no longer needed as a witness, and that spokesperson said yes. The letters still exist. The state's attorney has them. They've likely been shared with the Justice Department. That is, if the DOJ is interested in proceeding with hate crime charge. But to this point, there's been nothing from that front. Will it ever be used against him? I don't know. There is a pending civil trial, but that will mostly focus on the gun manufacturers. You may remember we spoke to attorney Antonio Romanucci, who's representing the victims in that civil trial, back in episode 2. I never wanted to be part of the story. I didn't want to testify. That was not part of my plan. But I'm not going to lie. That moment, getting called out in front of my colleagues, in front of the court, as terrifying as it was, it did inflate my ego a little. I had information. Information people wanted. Information people didn't know. It's a weird thing when you're a journalist, knowing something that hasn't been made public. On one hand, you want to scream it to the whole world. You want the exclusive, the one-on-one. And in doing so, not only do you release this thing that's been bottled up inside of you, but you're also hoping to get some street cred from your colleagues, from readers, from listeners, from viewers. Wow, that person's on the story. They know what they're talking about. They've got the dirt. Sometimes you want to conceal and hide that information, protect it until just the right time. Think about all those couples that withhold information about a pregnancy. They want to make sure that they have a healthy baby, or want to make sure that they get through a big project at work first, or they want to make the announcement in a certain way on social media. Sometimes they just like controlling the story as long as they can. But you also risk someone else breaking it, whether it be baby news or a news story. I guess the analogy still holds true. I reported on the letters in this podcast, but remember, I held on to them for months, waiting for that perfect time when jury selection was about to get underway. I went on John Williams' show and kind of beat around the bush until I finally said the thing. He has said some things to me that maybe would be worthy of the community getting out there.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm not going to read his statements to me because I don't want to be his mouthpiece, but I'll kind of give you three things he said here. Number one, he does not deny that he was the gunman that day. And in fact, the one thing that we've never had answered is the why. And from the letters that he's told me, I'll just summarize. I'm not going to use his words directly, but the attack from him was anti-Semitic. That was the goal when he was there. So he also made some references to Hamas, which seemed pretty nonsensical to me. But I don't think we had heard that before as far as a reason. Now, sometimes did a story immediately after the shooting that a rabbi had noticed him kind of lurking around a synagogue and thought it was strange, and security was involved in that. But nothing really came of it. So it kind of fits in that line. And then during one of the case management hearings, he did come out with a Quran, which was strange. He had never done that before. It was right after my letter exchange with him. And so I don't know if he's playing us. I really don't know if that's the case or not, but that seems to be the indication right now.
Brian Burrow is the WGN radio news director.
But in my mind, I built this up that it was going to be a big deal, or at least a bigger deal. Nobody had this. Nobody had established a motive before, but I had a letter. But you know what? It wasn't a huge story. I told you in previous episodes about the media echo chamber. If one publication reports something, others soon follow. I don't think anyone else picked this story up. Very few people have reached out to me about it. Ego's a funny thing. People mostly want to avoid being pegged as egotistical. We criticize those with big heads and the generation that wants to post everything they do on social media as if it's important to the world, that they're important to the world. But the ego's always there. It wants to come out. It's looking for approval, applause, maybe even concern or remorse. While part of me was relieved I didn't have to testify, that these letters weren't put in front of a jury and the media and Cremo himself, in the weeks that followed, part of me also wished they were. Not because it would do anything to help these victims or would have decided the case, but because my name was attached to it. And as I continue this journey, it's going to come out again. I'm going to keep digging for new information, new evidence, new people to talk to. I'm going to position that I'm just trying to get this information out there, that I'm trying to get the truth out. But deep in my mind, I also know I'm looking for approval. I'm desperately trying to get noticed. I'm guessing I'm not the only one. I used the word I 10 times in the last 20 seconds. Make that 12.
People every day are looking for recognition for their work, their athletic ability, their spirituality. They want to be noticed for their fashion, their hairstyle, their car, their weight loss, their choices. They want social media likes or a hat tip from their boss on an email. They want people to know how hard they work. They want to be known as the funny one, the healthy one, the pretty one, the smart one, the traveler, the one who has it all put together. We all want to be known for a thing. For that thing that everyone remembers, that impacts people's lives. It could be good. Sometimes it could be bad. This is Interrupting the Next Mass Shooting, Part 2. He's shooting. Here's a minute of 2024 active shooter statistics from the FBI. In 12 open space shootings in 2024, 4 happened on roadways, 3 in neighborhoods, and 3 in commercial spaces, 1 in a park, and 1 in a rural area. Of those 12, 7 happened in a single space, but 5 happened in multiple areas. The gunmen in open space shootings tended to be older, 5 between 35 and 44 years old, 2 under the age of 18, 3 between 19 and 24, and 3 between 25 and 34. 60% included a handgun, 33% with a rifle, just one incident, 7% with a shotgun. 9 of the 13 open space shooters were eventually apprehended alive. 2 died by suicide before law enforcement arrived. 2 were killed by law enforcement. The goal of this chapter is to find out what we can do if and when we're caught in this situation. How do we naturally respond? Can we train our brains to be better prepared? In episode 1, we talked with an FBI agent about the training they run through with civilians and law enforcement. In episode 2, we spoke with a Columbine survivor who hid in the cafeteria before eventually fleeing the school to a nearby home. In episode 3, we spoke to a police officer and a retired service member who rendered aid to victims and even worked to stop the threat. In this episode, we speak to the victims, the people caught in the gunfire. What would they have done differently? What could they have done differently? Harold Ng was in Cole Hall, a lecture hall at Northern Illinois University, on Valentine's Day 2008, when a former grad student, Kevin Kazmierczyk, armed with a shotgun and 3 pistols, entered through a back door and stepped onto the stage. He then started shooting. 5 people were killed, 17 others hurt before Kazmierczyk took his own life. Harold was in the back of the auditorium, and while not critically wounded, he was hit. Photos of him being loaded into an ambulance with a bloodied, bandaged head became one of the most remembered images of the devastating shooting. You were in the classroom in Cole Hall on February 14th, 2008. Not only that, you were hurt. Your image was plastered all over the news. Yep. Afterwards. Can you just kind of briefly walk me through that day? What happened from your perspective?
I mean, I could do it in like 30, but
there you go.
Basically, it happened so fast. So I was in the back of the classroom. And then when everything happened, I kind of just said, what are other people doing? And then I kind of, when I realized it was real, because I was starting to hear the noise, I pretty much ran out with everyone else, followed the crowd. And then I didn't know I had been injured. And so as I was getting closer, it was February, so it started getting really cold. And usually I don't get that cold. So once I brushed my hair back and I looked at my hands, it was just like completely red. So I was like, oh, I'd been hit. Ended up going to Neptune, and then from there, people still didn't know exactly what was going on.
Neptune? Neptune is
one of the dormitories at that time.
Okay.
So I got there safely, and then people started triaging it. All people started realizing it was real, and then some students, and then got me to a staircase, and from there, pretty much they were trying to stabilize my blood sugars. I remember numbers, which I think I went from an extreme high to an extreme low. So they said, like, for example, I don't remember exactly, but like blood pressure wise, it was like, hey, you went from like 40 to like 180 to like 180 over 90. So it was like two extremes in like a matter of like maybe 10 minutes or so. And then when they finally got me onto that gurney, I guess that's when the media had gotten hold of everything. And so after like many snaps, that picture of me in the gurney, that was the one that kind of went everywhere.
Yeah.
But I didn't even know. I was like, oh. So that was the one picture that went everywhere. So it was like, it happened so fast, obviously, kind of doing it in like 30 seconds. But sometimes I explain more, but it's like, I didn't really see anything. I'm also one of those things that a lot of people ask, like, did you see everything? It's like, at that point, I don't know what I saw. I'm basing it off what other people, kind of taking sure. other people's memories and intertwining it with everything else. So it's like, you know, so you fill the gaps in and stuff.
Yeah. No, I hear that a lot, actually. And I want to get into your book, because you wrote one called One Shot, One Life, Story of Inspiration. Mm-hmm. I believe you've had multiple editions of this. So is it just kind of as you go along, as you have more thoughts, you kind of insert them into the original book? Is that kind of the idea?
I mean, the original book, I mean, it was pretty much already set. The original book was titled That's Just It, which then after I looked at it, because my whole thing is all my endeavors and stuff, like I jokingly always want to be like as ambiguous as possible, because I personally, that's the way I think. I like that, like, the unknown. So it's like, would you pick up a book that's just it? It's like, what's just it? So then you want to go pick it up. But not everyone thinks like that. So as I work around stuff, people are like, you need to be more inspiring. And it's like, hey. And so one of my friends came up with the current title, which is the One Shot, One Life, Story of Inspiration. And so that one is the, and then I took, as I was reading other books as well, that one, I felt when I read, I actually read Ellie Raisman's book for a little bit, just for like inspiration, when I borrowed it from the library.
The gymnast, the famous gymnast. Yeah.
Yeah. She had a book, and I liked her format, because I was looking at formatting of books and stuff like that. So she had it where it was like pinpointing the parts in her life where it's like, oh, now this happened, this happened. So I was like, that's actually really good for my book.
And you go a little bit into your own life motivations. There's some creative writing in there. I think that the one thing that really I took from it, and I went through it all. You talk about the shooting from the gunman's perspective, which I too have read David Vann's book, Last Day on Earth, about the gunman in the NIU shootings, his life. Why did you decide to include and incorporate that into this book? Because a lot of the victims that I've spoken to, they want that person is dead to them. They don't want to talk about them. They don't want to reference them. Well, why did you decide that that's something you wanted to do?
So for me, I mean, it was obviously personal choice, but also I'm one of those, like, I don't know if this sounds kind of weird, but like I said, I'm one of those people that I want to say embrace. That's not the right word for this particular moment. But for example, if we're in a group or something, you're like, oh, don't watch the TV. I'm going to go watch it. So for me, it was kind of interesting to see, because like I said, in some of the works that aren't in there. And that's why, as I think, I'm like, should I incorporate this and stuff like that? Because once it happened to me, it kind of opened my mind to why not me? Right. Cause it's like people, you know, media will say, oh, doom, violent video games. Like even when, like I said, with like Columbine and stuff like that. And yes, some, that can be a partial part of it, but then according to media, I would be next, because I played all that stuff. I did all that stuff. I play Fortnite. I do those activities that, you know, people would be quick to say, hey, this is what has gone on. For me, it was just trying to intertwine the timelines. You know, obviously, I used a lot of the Vann book as well for some of it. And so I think it was just that, to show that dynamic and pinpoint, because it goes from being mostly comical, saying like, hey, you know, like I said, it's kind of the way I had it written was basically like a two-part series. So it's like, hey, part one, you got to the comical side, you feel really bad for him, he's gone through all this like emotional distress, and it couldn't get any worse, could it? And then obviously you go in, and then, oh, it's very journalistic, it's very you know, it's not random. It's literally pinpoint, you know, 1 p.m. this happens, and then 1 p.m. on the other side this happens. And so kind of intertwining it. But my main goal was, it was kind of like taking two timelines, merging it, two separate timelines, and then kind of writing it so that it ends up merging together, where it's like they meet. And so the timelines finally intersect, and then the story continues. No, that's, I think that was what I was trying to do.
Yeah. And you do it in a way where you kind of manipulate the font a little bit, so we know whose perspective. But this is interesting. He takes out his shotgun from his guitar case and begins to shoot. No emotion, no remorse. Do you remember seeing his face at all during that?
I personally didn't. I think that's from what other people have said, but also I think from reading some of the entries from like Van, but also utilizing. So that was, it took me a while to write, obviously, but when I was writing, I think a lot of the news articles were saying that, like, or like from other people's perspective, or when people reviewed it and stuff, that's where I got those inklings from. Cause like I said, I was in the way back. So everything to me, honestly, was a blur.
Yeah.
And everything, the only thing I really remember is, like I said, even it says in the book, like for the first time I actually cared about academics. So it's like, hey, I'm trying to get my book bag out the door. Wait, why don't I have energy to pick up my book bag? I've done it millions of times before.
Yeah.
And so I just left everything, like phone, everything was in there. And so I just had to leave because there was no energy and I didn't know what was going to happen next. So luckily, like I said, I was close to the door. So maybe when I turned, that's when I got hit by some of the residue from the shotgun.
Yeah. You didn't know who he was at that
time.
Not at all.
I didn't personally know.
Yeah. Do you think about him much 17 years later? Have you thought about him much or no?
Not really. I mean, obviously, when people talk about it, I do remember. And then I'm always wondering, like, you know, as I do my research or when people ask about it, if they, you know, each media outlet, if they do reach out to me, typically they always ask like some of the same questions and stuff. And so I try to like, oh no, I didn't know him. But at the same time, it makes me wonder, like I said, why is there a pattern? And so you look at it and it's like, again, he grew up, you know, they say like he grew up watching horror movies. He's the epitome of, and I'm like, but I do this. Like, I mean, I don't watch horror movies like crazy, but like, I think in the book Van, they were saying like, oh, he loved the movie Saw. And I'm like, you know what? I actually like that movie. I don't know if I can watch past the gore. I usually turn my way, but I love the way that the trap is set up. I love the storyline. But again, I know that's fictional, so I don't bring it into reality. So again, goes back to kind of what I was saying earlier, is like, what's the difference between, you know, me and him? And that's a question that I guess when people bring that up, I kind of always wonder, like, what makes me different? That
you guys were in the same age, going through the same experience at the same campus. I mean, there are obviously going to be similarities there, you know. So
or like even when you look at, even if he's older or whichever, which I think he was, because he was a little older.
Yeah,
he was probably like, you know, how old I am now, is which is crazy. Like I said, I can't believe it's like, you know, 15 plus years now. But essentially, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, you go through something and it's like, some people, like even now, you know, flash forward now, it's like, why do people ask for, as I work in theme park world, it's like accommodations, why do people ask for these? Or, you know, why do other people, you know, need like medication or psychiatrists? I've dealt with it for myself for so long. Is it safe? No, not at all, probably. But somehow I've managed. And so that always makes me kind of wonder, like, if I can, why can't you? But everyone's different. So,
yeah. All right. So you were in the classroom, you were in the back. This gunman, my understanding is there's like a stage kind of situation up there. And that's where he kind of revealed himself.
It's like the back door. Yeah.
Yeah. How long did it take for you to realize that there was something wrong and that you were in danger? Because I think a lot of us think that, oh gosh, you see a gun, you get the heck out of there. But sometimes you watch this stuff and it takes a while for your brain to realize, wait, is what I'm seeing real? And am I in danger?
I mean, honestly, I couldn't tell you exactly. I mean, you'd have to probably watch I'd probably have to watch like live. I don't think there is any, but because we were in that, we were just transitioning to that digital age, 2008.
No one was walking around with iPhones, or if they did, it would have been like one of the first ones, right?
Dude, flip phones, man. I was with that Razor.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is something I wanted to add in my book eventually, but that's something that's just random plans and stuff. But no, I think honestly, I wouldn't know for certain. All I know, if this indicates any time frame, would be hearing like the back door open, and then there's two people on stage. And at that point, you know, whatever was happening at that time.
That's weird, like, right? Two people on stage is weird.
Correct.
That's
and
not
I was like,
normal.
It's weird because usually it was just the teacher or maybe his TA, but usually it was just the one, and he was doing his lecture because it's a big auditorium. So a panel, essentially, like if you look at it that way, but it's like, hey, I'm teaching my class, doing my presentation. So yeah, that was weird. But then it wasn't, you know, something that could have been out of the norm. Because we were just happening to talk about, you know, rock sediment, things like that. So once that happened, I think, like I said, things started picking up. And then even then, I wasn't aware of what's going on. It's one of those things where you're like kind of just in shock and you're like kind of just staring. It's like, wait, is this part of it? What are other people doing? Because obviously I've never been in this situation before. I don't know what the heck's going on. It was like that video game moment because it's like, is this a video game? Is this real? If it's real, what should I do? Because what are other people doing? But also, I'm in the far back. And I remember, for me personally, once everything started calming down in the sense of, like, going back to, snapping back to reality, because it was like, you're heightened, everything's like kind of like that, when they do that movie cinematic type thing where it's like, everything is a slow motion. But now you're back in, like, reality. Where's my friend? Oh, he's gone. If he's gone, because he's usually in class, if he's gone, everyone else is gone. Okay, now the chaos is actually happening. I think I should run. So since I was in the far back, that's when I started kind of running and not even realizing like the full magnitude of what's really going on. I mean, so time frame wise, probably, I mean, heck, like I said, it's so hard to know. It's just even in the book, like I said, it's based on what other people said. And so could be anywhere from like 2 to 5 minutes. I would probably say like closer to that 2 minute mark, because like I said, it happened so fast. Cause it's like, I remember it was like right around like 3:08. He bursts in and then the chaos ensues. And so, like I said, hearing the shotgun. And then after that, it's like whatever else other people have said from the media and stuff, that's what I'm basing my experience from. Sure. Cause I don't remember any of that, because like I said, once that happens, I pretty much just ran.
Yeah. I'm one of the things that I've been digging deeper onto is when people realize there's something wrong and when they choose to react a certain way. You didn't even know that you had been hit at that point.
Yeah, I didn't even know.
Yeah, you probably just saw other people and realized, hey, this is what I need to do now is get the heck out of here.
Correct.
But without probably much thinking, there's a lot. I mean, this was 17 years ago too. So, I mean, you're going to lose perspective. Your perspective is going to change quite a bit too, based on what other people have told you, what you think you're filling in the gap that may or may not have happened. Is there something that does stick out to you to this day that you remember very vividly, whether it be a smell, a sound, a sight, something, a person's reaction? Is there something that 17 years later, like a flash or maybe a couple flashes that you do remember?
I mean, not really. For me, it's so suppressed that whatever's random could trigger it. So I really wouldn't be able to comfortably tell you like, hey, this reminds me of something or something. But I know like a lot of people, obviously you hear from a lot of survivors, I'm sure, where they say like big loud noises. And for me particularly, not even like I've gotten pretty good. So like I usually don't like fireworks that you can see versus the fireworks that people just pop off. But I've moved somewhere where it's like not as loud. So that's always good that they weren't able to put them off this year. So I didn't hear as much. So those ones, I think a lot of when bikes purposely break their muffler and it's like that loud like boom, that always bothers me.
So your mind does remember the sound of gunshots.
Yeah,
apparently.
I think so.
Apparently, if this triggers you, then your mind does
probably something like that. Like if it was that fast, because like I said, maybe one of them. Like I heard one of the maybe blasts. I don't know, but it's just obviously I think association with that too. It's like,
sure.
Like I said, I go watch a movie. I know when there's an explosion and stuff. Like I typically put one hand. Like one hand near my ear and just cover up and dampen partially the sound. you know, things like that. So I think like loud noises typically do, because it's just the nature of what it possibly sounds like and what I remember. The only thing that I vividly always remember, but it's nothing like, doesn't give me like flashbacks or anything like that. It's just when I talk about it with other people, people are like, you didn't even know you were injured, or like, how were you were injured? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I honestly, like I said, even in my original piece that inspired me to write the entire book, where I won a contest for that, I basically said, like, you know, I brushed my hair back. At first I was scratching my head. I was like, I'm cold. I picked at it, just the fingertips were bloody. And I was like, it's just a scab. But each time I walked, I was like, one, I'm getting weak, right? I don't know why, but I just feel weaker every step I take. But also, like, I feel really cold. So it's not a scab at this point, right? Because why would I be so cold? Usually I'm like energetic. Usually I'm always really warm. So then when I brushed over my hair completely, and like my whole hand was red, I was like, oh, I was injured.
Yeah.
And so like those, you know, that kind of thing always reminds me of it.
Have you healed completely? Are there any physical ramifications of what happened or no?
Physically, I'm fine. I think a lot of it.
There's no fragments still in your head or anything?
No,
like that.
Not for me personally. I don't think so. They said it based on what I remember. They're like, your head has layers. It penetrated like, you know, the first two layers. So eventually as your skin grows, kind of like a snake or whatever, your hair grows, you'll push it out. So I don't have anything. I know one of my really good friends still has some shrapnel. So it must have penetrated a little bit more deeper, but he was also closer. But, you know, things like that. But I was fortunate to be in the far back. So a lot of it was just the scraps and, you know, residue and stuff.
Is there anything in hindsight, granted 17 years later, that you think you could have done or should have done differently to better protect yourself, better protect others around you? I mean, have you done any of that Monday morning quarterbacking at all since the shooting?
I mean, in hindsight, obviously I'm still dealing with it. I still struggle. A lot of it could be pride, counseling, finding help. I think for me, knowing that, I think the hardest part is knowing that someone is out there for you to understand, even, and other people who, even if they don't understand, they're trying to understand. So I think that's the best way, because like, I dealt with it for so long myself before I finally opened up to that. So even for me, like the first month, I think it took me probably like a month before I finally actually ended up talking to someone. And so I was out of it for like a month, pretty much, as far as I can remember. And then a lot of it, like I kind of touch base it with my book as well. But I think timing, you know, it's not something, don't push it aside, whether it's small or big, you know, like give yourself your own time. Like everyone's different. Like you have to realize that. So it could take me like, you know, a month, or maybe some people take 6 months or even up to, but like, we're still struggling with it. Like I'm still dealing with it. Like you said, 17 years later, was that the best choice that I did? Probably not. I think for me, trying to rush it where I wanted to be normal so bad, and what is normal, right? But at the same time, I wanted to be, I guess, as close to normal as I could be. So I definitely didn't take my time. And so because I didn't, I know what it feels like. So that's why sometimes I go on when certain events happen that I feel inclined to like talk about it. So for example, obviously there's probably a lot that go on now, but the last one that was significant was obviously Florida State University. So I jumped on live and I kind of just explained where my situation was. And I told people like, you know, give yourself time. Like, you know, right now, I'm just creating a safe place, kind of giving you advice that I've been through something. And the most important thing is give yourself the time that you need. Don't think that, you know, you want to rush it at all. I think that those would probably be the two that if I could go back and really rethink it, it'd be like, give myself the time and then go definitely, whether you're talking to them or not, but definitely go and talk to someone and get that counseling help. Cause like I said, I think it took me a month, and that month was probably like the hardest month in my entire life, honestly.
In the book, you talk about seeing similar shootings on TV. You mentioned the Pulse nightclub shooting. Mm-hmm. Is there something that connects you with Parkland and Vegas and Pulse and some of these other shootings?
Highland Park? For sure. I mean, obviously, we're in a group that we don't really exist in. Some of them more than others. So I think when all the other ones happen, like, I want to say I'm totally like desensitized to it. And I think right now, even with the media, it's like we're so accustomed to it. But the one that stood out to me, I think Parkland, just because I remember what I remember is we were 15 years in, and then all of a sudden, like, it happened. And so I didn't want to even believe it was real, because it's like, why on Valentine's Day? Like, there's no way. But when it did, the fact that it was like pretty much almost identical situation to ours, but obviously on a bigger, I think a lot more got injured and a lot more, died. But the fact that it happened at the same time, that kind of affected me a lot more. And so I remember once I was reading into it, because it's like, oh, another one. And I read into it as much as I could. I remember just breaking down completely, because I was like, wait, what? And then when I was questioning my friends, I'm like, I'm stronger than this. Like, I saw the pulse, like you mentioned. I've seen this. Why am I being so weak? It's like, think about it, Harold. It's like, I don't want to think. I don't. And it's like, and then once I broke it down, it's like, oh, right. It happened the same time, the same, pretty much the same day, same time.
At a school.
Yeah.
A student. Was there a social media group combining the victims of various mass shootings together? Was there a private Facebook group for people to share, some kind of social media for these people to connect?
There is. I think they found us, because I think a lot of it, obviously, depending on how many people you've talked to over the past. But basically, I think they kind of found us as well, or like we find them, because I remember when Columbine did happen and stuff, like, or not when Columbine happened, when our shooting happened, obviously the Virginia Tech, some of the Virginia Tech students reached out to us, and then some of the Columbine. So like they were always there, and I never knew them until they reached out, and I was able to be part of their group. And so they've expanded since everything, but it was essentially, it's a bunch of Columbine survivors. I just got back from Denver not too long ago, because that's where they're stationed. And so, and then they expanded it, I think, to once Aurora happened, that's where they kind of merged the projects together. So it's just one big group. And so when people look for them, you can find it. And so it's like, it is private. So then they do their best to keep it. They have moderators, so they do their best to keep politics, keep everything out.
You mentioned in the book, and we've already talked about, you're kind of plastered all over TV, that image of you being brought out on the gurney with your head. What did you think of that image when you first saw it? And then what do you think about it now? Has your perspective changed?
I mean, I make it more comical now. I just laugh. I'm like, how did he even get that? Like, without my consent, that's the worst part about it. No, I mean, it hasn't really changed. I think it's just weird that was that moment captured in time and space now, right? And what's cool, I mean, for me, obviously, as other shootings happen, I'm always, I don't know if that's the right word, but like, dumbfounded or bewildered, I guess, kind of like how far media has come, right? Because at that point, it was still that capture that moment, picture, write about the caption, and then kind of write the articles that way, versus now, like, everything's like digital. It's like, hey, Harold, did you happen to take a picture of that? Or it's like, dude, I have the whole thing on like my Snapchat. It's hard to even imagine, because like I said, it was the early infancies. Like, Twitter was just beginning, and now it's X, right? Like, my friends and I, we always joke around. It's like, man, can you imagine, like, what if this happened to us in like 2010, or like when media was around? Like, who would have been the most famous person? It's like, probably me. I'm like, oh man, that's crazy, because like I was always big on social media, so like Facebook, Twitter, stuff like that. Like, for example, I'm trying, but it's hard, because I'm still trying to find my niche on some of the social platforms. Back to kind of the question, there's no like specifics. Like, I never looked at it differently. I remember my dad saying, like, we need to try to do our best to try to hide all the newspapers and stuff from my grandma, because she's already have so much to worry about. We don't want her worrying about us and stuff like that, not knowing that would have, you know, because we like don't even tell her, but it's like we didn't know that picture would actually reach. That was the picture that also ended up going to like I think one of our friends ended up giving us like a Thailand newspaper or something like that, and it was that picture, and we're like, dude, that's the picture that went global, like what the heck. Like, so
is there anything that we in the media do wrong that you wish we would change when we cover these kind of stories? You've obviously seen quite a few over the last 17 years. We've mentioned some of them here.
Yeah.
Is there anything that maybe we, having been through the media grinder, and apparently 17 years later still being through the media grinder talking to me, is there anything that you wish we would consider, things that we're getting wrong, things that maybe we should look at differently?
I mean, it's really hard to say, because in the media world, as like I said, I do my best to post. It's like what grabs our attention, right? So, or what grabs the mass attention. So when it's shocking news or something like that, then it's like, here's the situation, here's the shooter. So a lot of it's not really at your fault, but obviously there's not much we can do. But if there was the way, it would be like, you know, I guess the best way to kind of put it would be like limit screen time for the shooter. So it's like, don't focus on the shooter or the shooting, but it's like, how do you say it? It's like, focus more on the casualties or the effects of the thing, and not mention, like a lot of people would probably say, like, don't mention the shooter. For me, it has, like I said, for me, everyone's different. So like, I personally have no say really. As I know, like I said, media, I want the most shocking too. But at the same time, obviously, you know, that's where a lot of, I think, you know, copycat crimes come into play, because when people focus on, when media or like other information, we focus on the shooter or the incident, I think people are like, oh, I like the way they did that, or that guy's a hero, you know, stuff like that, where they say that, then that's where, so it's like, is there a way where it's like, we don't release that information? So it's like, oh, a shooting happened at the school, and this is what happened. Here, the perpetrator, have a sketching of it versus the actual picture. Because I think nowadays, everything's so much easier to media grab. We grab the picture, and so people are like, oh, yeah, that's my hero now. But if it's like a sketch, then we're not focused on the shooter itself, kind of thing.
Thanks for listening to Interrupting the Next Mass Shooting, Chapter 2, He's Shooting. We'll pick the series back up again this fall when we discuss security and policies aimed at preventing the shootings in the first place. I'm Ryan Burrow.